So fortunately, for this session that will run till about noon, we have Ellie and Yaprak with us. So the discussion should be somewhat easier than what we just accomplished, although we all feel that went a lot better than we had feared. So this is terrific. So you've all had the papers, and I've asked Ellie and Yaprak to take about 8 or 10 minutes to summarize their papers, and then Bill Quandt, who's with us, will provide 12 or 14 minutes or so of comments, and then we'll throw it open to discussion. So as you can read from the bios, I'm going to ask Yaprak to go first. And she's written extensively on Turkey and democratization, Turkey and the European Union, and most importantly, on civil-military relations inside Turkey. So I'll just turn it over to her now for 8 to 10 minutes.
Well, thank you very much. Let me begin by saying that I'm very grateful that I'm back in Charlottesville at UVA, and thank you very much for inviting me. I should start summarizing the paper by saying that the main strategic goal of Turkey today is to become a regional power with global influence. Here the region is defined broadly, so it's not only the Middle East, but the Balkans, the Caucasus, and even Africa. But we can see that Turkish foreign policy is geared towards the Middle East more today than other regions, and there are several reasons for this. First, of course, since the Arab uprisings, the Middle East is in a turbulent state, and this is something that Turkish foreign policy needs to take into account. And also the second reason why the Middle East is so much more important for Turkey is the orientation of the moderately Islamic Justice and Development Party government and Prime Minister Erdogan. In fact, before the Justice and Development Party government, Turkish foreign policy was mostly status quo oriented, and it was defensive. The primary foreign policy decision makers were the military and the bureaucrats of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. For these secular elites, the left, Kurdish nationalism and religious fundamentalism were perceived as the domestic threats, like the primary domestic threats that had important connections with international forces and especially connections in neighboring countries. So Turkey viewed its surrounding regions as particularly insecure and dangerous. But Turkish foreign policy began to change after the Cold War. This new era presented new opportunities and challenges for Turkey. One of the challenges was that Turkey felt that it lost its geostrategic importance for the West. And that it had to prove that it was worthy of Western alliance again after the Cold War. So, for instance, Turkey willingly participated in the first Gulf War in order to show that it was still a valuable ally. The newly independent states in the Balkans and the Caucasus were, however, perceived as an opportunity for Turkey. And it was believed that Turkey could be a leader in these regions and could have good relations that had historical ties with Turkey. And at the same time, kill two birds with one stone. It can become a soft power in the region by being this leader and also prove its worth to the West as and still an important, valuable ally in the turbulent neighborhood. These goals in Turkish foreign policy became more pronounced after 2002 when the Justice and Development Party won the elections. The advisor of Prime Minister Erdogan, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who later became the foreign minister, put forward four main aims for Turkish foreign policy. First, Turkey would pursue a no problems with its neighbors policy, which was a major shift compared with the past. Second, economic and diplomatic ties would be preferred in handling foreign relations rather than coercive and military instruments. Third, Turkey would be a model for the region as an Islamic country that is also democratic. And Turkey would also be a mediator of regional disputes and tap into this identity, its identity as a Western democracy and Islamic plural society. Fourth, given Turkey's historical and cultural roots, and I mean its Ottoman heritage here, Turkey thought that it could serve as a bridge between Europe, Asia, and Africa. Here, the most important point was not pursuing good relations with the Middle East, Asia, and Africa only, but also keeping its close ties with the West. Turkey thought that it was in a unique position to do this, that it could refer to the past and say we are both Western and Asian or Middle Eastern at the same time. It was believed that if Turkey could pursue all of these goals successfully, then it would become an important regional power, which was the ultimate goal. However, in many respects, Turkey has become unsuccessful in pursuing these goals. The last aim was the one that unraveled the first. Turkey could not keep an equal distance to the West and the East. Only a year after the Justice and Development Party won the elections in 2003, the parliament rejected participating in the Second Gulf War. After 2004, Prime Minister Erdogan vocally and in an increasingly offensive manner began to criticize Israel. And in 2006, the negotiations between Turkey and the EU for membership came to a halt. All of these developments put pressure on Turkey's relations with the West. The other aims of Turkish foreign policy turned out to be difficult goals since especially the start of the Arab uprisings. Ankara's policy towards Syria is a clear example. So it's clear when you look at the Syrian example that Turkey is not seeking economic and diplomatic ties with the region anymore. That it is using coercive instruments, that it is not a country that has no problem with its neighbors. No, it has major problems with Syria and its neighbors. And it's not a leader or a country that can keep an equal distance to parties of a dispute in its neighborhood. Now Turkey supplies arms to insurgents, including radical groups. More than 500,000 Syrian refugees reside in Turkey. It has been claimed that the Damascus regime carried out a terrorist attack in a border province. In June 2012, the Syrians shot down a Turkish plane. And very recently, Turkey fired a missile to a Syrian warplane. For all intents and purposes, Turkey is right now in a tacit war with Syria that could become an explicit war very soon and very quickly. Moreover, Ankara's Middle Eastern policy in general and Syrian policy in particular bring it in conflict with the USA and other regional powers such as Iran and Russia. So under these conditions, it is very difficult for Turkey to become a leader in its region. Yet Turkey still clinges to this idea and stripped of the other instruments or the other goals that Davutoğlu had put forward. Now Turkey is trying to appeal to the Middle Eastern publics and claiming to be the representatives of the Sunni people. And so this became the only means to become a regional power. The primary actor in foreign policy decision making is right now Prime Minister Erdogan. Davutoğlu has been the theoretical and intellectual father of Turkish foreign policy, but Erdogan clearly has the final say today. The Justice and Development Party came to power with a coalition of elite forces. The Gulen movement and the liberal intellectuals backed the Justice and Development Party in its initial years, and together they dismantled the influence of the military in Turkish politics and foreign policy. But in the last few years, Erdogan and his close aides, especially Hakan Fidan, the Secretary of National Intelligence Agency, started to act alone. The previous supporters of the government questioned foreign policy decisions and criticized the authoritarian manner in which Erdogan is ruling the country. The prosecutors, who are suspected of being linked to the Gulen movement, started a corruption investigation in December, and they several times intercepted trucks that were carrying arms to Syria. But these arms were disguised as humanitarian aid carried out by a civil society organization known as the IHH. This is the organization that had previously organized the infamous aid flotilla to Gaza. National Intelligence Agency was protecting the trucks, so the agency and the prosecutors drew guns at one another during the search of these trucks. And Erdogan has struck back against these investigations and has blamed foreign powers, the USA and Israel in particular, for weakening the country. And because foreign policy issues are at the core of the rift between the Gulen movement and Erdogan, the prime minister does not only tie the enemies together, but he also ties the victims together. So in his discourse, all publicly elected politicians and righteous Sunnis of the region are being attacked by the West and its regional collaborators. Israel, of course, is there, but the Gulen movement and others in domestic politics are to blame as well. Turkey is going to face a general election and a presidential election in 2 years' time. And if Erdogan wins the presidential elections in August, we could expect to see the same strategic ambitions to continue in the near future. Now we can summarize these ambitions as being a regional power by representing the oppressed Sunni people of the Middle East and by defying Western powers if and when necessary. But given that Turkey's relations with its neighbors and the West has changed several times since the early 1990s, it would not be surprising if the foreign policy visions of the government are altered once again due to regional developments as well as domestic changes in the balance of power.
Thanks. Perfect. 8 to 10 minutes. Ellie, I'll turn it over to you. You can read his bio, but Ellie has written extensively on nuclear issues, nuclear abolition, nuclear proliferation, and also on Israeli military doctrine. And at various times, he's had leading positions in the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission and in the Ministry of Defense. So we're looking forward to hearing your summary.
Thank you. I'm actually torn between giving a real summary of my paper and trying to adjust to the some of the discussion we already had this morning in terms of somewhat going beyond the paper.
That would be fine for you to go beyond.
So I have tried to summarize the paper actually in whatever, half a dozen slides. So maybe what I do is 5 minutes, go over the slides, and then go a little bit beyond this, because I think the discussion is actually evolving in a very interesting direction. We should go beyond the papers as they're currently composed.
Excellent.
So to be very, very brief, and you have the slides in front of you, so we ended up finding ourselves in a situation where the state was founded under rather adverse conditions in 1948. We tried to formulate a vision. That vision was echoed in the Declaration of Independence. It has a semi-legal status, but only a semi-legal status, and so on, that define the aspirational attributes of Israeli destiny and so on. Some of the issues were not even codified there because there was no consensus, and there has largely been no consensus making the sort of a formal definition of the aspirational goals since. And we are really struggling, and I would say in leaping forward, we're in the most acute identity crisis that we have ever been at the current time. Okay, on practically every single issue, domestic as well as international. Okay, so the original defining issues, if I now go to slide 3, have been the borders, sovereignty, and international recognition, and so on. Sovereignty at the time was defined exclusively in the context of external players recognizing Israel's sovereignty. One of the points I'm trying to make in the paper is that the sovereignty issue has now become a very important issue also in terms of what happens inside Israel and not just outside Israel. But that, again, I don't want to go into too much detail and so on. Clearly, the desire to have relations of peace between Israel and its neighbors that initially looked like totally out of the realm of the possible, subsequently were codified with Jordan and Egypt, and discussions had gone on with the others. But I think that this is a hotly contested issue now, and we'll get to that as we go on. This whole complex relationship between Israel, the diaspora, and so on. In fact, Israel identity is being somewhat bigger than itself. It's not just a state, but it's the embodiment of the Jewish homeland and has a very special relationship with Jewish Jewry, and therefore, in terms of its aspiration, is not confined just to the narrow territorial limits of Israel, but actually the diaspora plays a very big role in the vision, in the aspiration, and so on. And lots of issues that are domestic, presumably in nature, but each of them resonates beyond Israel's borders in terms of the relationship between Jewish in the national sense and Jewish in the religious sense of the word, and between being a Jewish state and a more pluralistic, multi-ethnic state, which was already the reality at the time, except that it has changed fundamentally over the years. I've listed the factors that are, I think, playing in the process, and I don't want to go into them other than to say only one thing. There are such powerful players involved in trying to shape the policy that looking at the formal organs would not actually tell you a great deal, number one. And number two, it would actually, you have to look at all of these in order to understand why it is we have such a difficult time formulating a grand strategy that is coherent in nature. Because you not only look at the domestic factors, but the U.S. factors, and I would say, and the external factors, and I would just say the U.S. is as much a domestic force in Israel as it is an international force. I mean, and in fact, I mean, I'm kind of half-jokingly, I would say, where is Shadel Adelson more of a player? In the U.S., in Israel, in both? You know, I have my own views about what I think of his role. But, I mean, the guy subsidizes the largest circulation Israeli daily and so on, which advocates a certain campaign, I mean, and the most aggressive one. So he is a force of nature. And the resources in such a small country make a huge difference.
As of yesterday, he's going to become larger here, too. So
we are not talking about his contribution to Macau. We're trying to talk about... okay, and then as I try to close these very opening remarks before I move on to a few small short reflections that go beyond the papers... So I listed the issues in the slide six, the elements of the current vision... Where I think the most interesting to look at are, number one, the territorial issue that was never resolved in 48 has become a huge, huge issue. There is a significant segment of Israeli society that now defines Jewishness, Israeliness, and so on in territorial terms ahead of religious terms, ahead of other terms and so on, in ways that had not existed in the past and which clearly has a bearing on sort of the peace process and American-Israeli relations and practically every other issue that you can think of, including the democratic nature of the state. So I'm just listing that as a big issue. Sovereignty with the Arab population having grown to the extent it is within Israel borders, the sovereignty of the state in that part of the world, in that part of the country, has become an issue. And the Bedouins in the Negev have become another major problem and so on. And clearly sovereignty issues in terms of the West Bank is a third cluster of sovereignty challenges and so on, because in some parts it becomes part of the state and in other parts it's not. And I'm not even talking about the Golan Heights. So sovereignty has assumed a very different than the traditional IR definition of what sovereignty is all about in Israel of 2014. The Jewish character of the state is at the heart, not of just the Israeli domestic debate, but also in terms of its relationship with its neighbors, with now currently at the core of the discussion with the Palestinians, but also with the rest of the Arab world in the context, and so on. And it's clearly become an issue in American-Israeli relations, and so on. So you understand that. The last issue that I would point out here is that I think the issues of social cohesion are incredibly important in terms of thinking ahead about a grand strategy for Israel and how that grand strategy reflects the desire to retain or consolidate social cohesion, which is currently rather frayed, and there is really no national ethos on most issues that people share. And so the bottom line, as I see it, and I again race ahead, is that things are reasonably well defined in the narrower definition of security and military component. The political dimension of the security doctrine is in complete state of flux, and so on. The economic component of the grand strategy seems reasonably well defined and are generally a success story, but that assumes you can actually separate it either from the politics or from the social-cultural dimensions, which you cannot, and the latter part remains extraordinarily fuzzy. And so, as a surprise, surprise, you don't have a cohesive grand strategy at the end, as the end result of it. So now I'll just spend 2 minutes. Do I still have 2 minutes?
Yes, sure.
Okay. So I just want to go beyond the paper now and say the following. And again, taking some of the discussion, particularly Phil's comments this morning as a kind of a marching orders. Starting out in 48, the real issue is survival, okay? And in second place, the prosperity aspect that would make this it's kind of a tenable proposition. So with that, the goals are essentially very modest in most respects, very ambitious in terms of let's make sure we stick around, but rather very modest in every other respect. We can't shape, we're a small state, we're a weak state, we can't really shape things a lot beyond and so on. Let our mind our own business. Let our try our very best to try and build this into initially fortresses, really, if you wish, and so on, and try to make this kind of a sustainable proposition. And influencing things beyond one's border was seen as something where you could have very limited influence. And mostly, and I emphasize the word mostly because I think this is a very sharp contrast to what the normal way we would think about Israel, mostly in soft power, not in hard power. So we, through agricultural assistance to African states or to science and technology or spiritual aspects and so on, would throw a greater weight around not just among Jews in the world, which clearly is part of the ambition, and so on, but this will be based on, to you, to summarize it all, on some excellence, okay? And so you had, from the 1950s, that instinct translated into trying to project soft power, but again with the realization that you had a limited ability to actually play that role. And other than that, you know, from a narrow security perspective, let's do kind of an alliance of the periphery of the non-Arab or non-Islamic elements around the Middle East. Relation with Turkey came into that, as well as relations with Iran and so on, Horn of Africa and so on. And play a disproportionate role with the Jewish world. So all kinds of institutions and structures were created to actually be able to solidify, sustain the bonds with the Jewish world and not just serve in that respect as the Jewish homeland, as the place of last resort where they can actually seek refuge in, but also in terms of trying to influence the discussion that goes on there and so on. But the global the neighborhood were things that you could not really shape. You were too small, too weak, too vulnerable, too limited, and so on. As the state grew somewhat stronger, economically, militarily, and so on, there has been a hope of maybe we could play a somewhat bigger role in shaping the environment rather than being more defensive and so on. There have been a series of humbling experiences, peace experience process, particularly with the Palestinians being one of them, Lebanon, you know, through military, throwing your military for a might around and so on. And more recently, the Arab Spring, which have only shown that we had basically, let's mind our own business. And we could surgically do things here and there and so on, but in essence, where we could really play a bigger role would only be in the soft power domain, except that we haven't been cultivating that as much as we have in the early years of the state. So it hasn't been assuming such a great... I think that in terms of the present, and here is where I want to conclude, two things are quite striking in my judgment. The first, and you won't find that concept anywhere. So if you actually look, and this goes to some of the methodological issues I wanted to discuss, if you actually look at the formal discussion, there is nothing to that effect. I think the best characterization of Israeli strategy, or even grand strategy, has been virtual relocation. Let's build higher fences with our immediate neighbors and pretend we're living elsewhere in the world. Economic ties with Asia, political security ties with the United States, economic ties with Europe, and so on. We don't believe that we can actually have ultimately normal relations with our neighbors, and maybe that's not even such a great goal in the first place. Let's find some way of living in the Middle East and pretending we don't live there. By the way, remarkable in the sense that it's proven generally successful with occasional reminders that it's easier said than done, except that I'm saying that it's not even said. I think it's the practice as distinguished from the stated goal. And the other point where I want to wrap up is that I think that a lot of the grand strategy is now beginning to be challenged by a new perception of the role that the U.S. plays in the region for Israel in terms of Israeli-American relations and so on, as a result of a sense that the U.S., on the one hand, is pivoting away from the Middle East to some extent, is retrenching in some other respects, or playing more reluctant global leader and so on, maybe less than competent in its playing some other aspects of its role and so on, and that Israel grand strategy has been so intimately tied to thinking the U.S., and the U.S. first, and in fact the U.S. has already said is a domestic issue. It's not an international issue. It's a domestic issue. That opens a whole series of issues of who we are, what are we trying to do, how are we trying to go with it, and so on. And the most interesting manifestation is a debate that is going all over the place now in Israel, and every possible circle is about our relationship with China.
Thank you. I'll ask Bill Kwan, who has written very extensively on the peace process, and he's an emeritus professor here at UVA, and we're delighted you're here today, Bill. Please.
Thank you very much. Well, first, let me say that I thought both of the papers and presentations were very stimulating and gave us lots of issues to think about. In some ways, Turkey and Israel in the contemporary Middle East look like countries that are actually not doing so badly compared to many of the others. So it's interesting that in both cases we hear descriptions of countries that are deeply divided over their foreign policies, that don't seem very happy with the circumstances they find themselves in. And yet I think you can still say that comparatively speaking, Turkey and Israel seem to have better prospects, both in terms of their domestic situations and their foreign policies, than, say, Egypt or Syria or Iraq or any number of other countries in the region. That may be not too reassuring, given that the problems they do face are serious, but they're not the kind of problems that some of the other neighbors have. I'm tempted to say that the Middle East has been a pretty challenging region for anybody who imagines that grand strategies really can be formulated and implemented. We've seen a lot of efforts, though. I mean, people never quite give up on the idea that you can approach a region like the Middle East and somehow reshape it in a design that suits your purposes. The British, who probably had the best shot at it after World War I, eventually ran up against the phenomena of nationalism and anti-colonialism, and eventually found themselves reduced to a very limited role in the Middle East. But they had a good long run of a grand strategy that left a lot of pieces of a puzzle in place, but it has to be ultimately viewed as a failure. I think American recent efforts at reshaping the Middle East, which included the intervention in Iraq, which was, I think, part of an attempt to change the direction of developments in the Middle East, looks pretty much like a failure now. Most things didn't work out the way we had hoped. And I think you're seeing a reaction on the part of Americans to the idea of trying to remake the Middle East in some kind of a democratizing, pro-American, Western-allied orientation. Turning to the countries in the Middle East, I think we have seen, both with some Israeli leaders and the current Turkish prime ministers, an attempt not to shape the Middle East, but to deal with the Middle East with a kind of strategic approach that also didn't work. I would say that Sharon, both as defense minister in the early 1980s and as prime minister, did think of the Middle East as a strategic region that could be shaped. And Lebanon, pretty much in 1982, undid that and almost undid his career. Amazing that you get second chances, however, in the Middle East, despite often pretty egregious stumbles.
But interestingly, when he did, he was sufficiently humbled that he didn't try it again.
He didn't try it again, but he, I think his attempt to deal with, I mean, there was a strategic dimension to the withdrawal from Gaza. It wasn't probably even popular in the country at the time, but he was a leader who said, in order to preserve X, we have to do Y. There was a degree of strategic thinking about at least the limited strategic space that Israel lived in. Prime Minister Erdogan and his foreign minister had a brief moment when it looked like their attempt to deal with the Middle East in a different way and to deal with their international relations in the Middle in a different way was working. I would, a slight difference of emphasis with Yaprak, I would say that the deterioration in the U.S. in the Turkish-Israeli relationship did not start immediately after Erdogan came to power. After all, as late as 2008, there were talks going on, mediated by Turkey between Israel and Syria, and Prime Minister Olmert went to Turkey shortly, or toward the end of 2008, and Turkey was playing a kind of mediating role, which, as far as I could tell, from talking to people on both the Israeli and the Syrian side, was highly appreciated. They were doing it very professionally, and it was really after that collapsed and after the Iron Cast-led operation in Gaza that Erdogan reacted quite harshly toward what he seemed to think was a kind of betrayal of the relationship that he had developed with Olmert. And today, Turkey's no problems on the borders looks pretty unrealistic. I would, however, ask Yaprak in particular to reflect a little bit on how much was this Erdogan, his ideology, his Islamist orientation, and how much was it instead a kind of understandable reaction to what I think has to be seen as a European rebuff of the Turkish attempt to join the European Union, which after all had been a central theme of Turkish foreign policy for some time, and yet it became increasingly unrealistic when Germany and France made it pretty clear that the barrier to Turkish entry would be very high, whereas by contrast for Cyprus and others, it would be not so difficult. So I think the turn away from the kind of orientation toward Europe and the West is not just peak and a kind of personal ideological quirk of Erdogan's. It is also a sense that the whole European issue is no longer as central or as feasible and perhaps not as necessary. Turkey got many of the economic benefits of membership without becoming a member, and it was discovering there were economic issues in the Middle East where, after all, the price of oil had gone up and there were customers in the Gulf who were eager to buy Turkish products and Turkish workers. I think the Middle East became an area of interest that would have been compelling even if the CHP had remained in power. Maybe not as much so, maybe not with the same justification, but some of the shift in Turkish foreign policy, I think, has to be seen as more structural and less idiosyncratic, perhaps, than you're describing. Let me reflect on a couple of points about both of the papers that really did strike me as, I think both Israel and Turkey have had a hard time developing and sustaining anything that would be worthy of being called a grand strategy, apart from some very core issues that were areas of strong consensus in both countries. But in terms of the more ambitious goals of trying to interact with the region, shape the region, play a larger role in the region, it's been very difficult. Now, two reasons that stand out in my mind for the difficulty of pursuing the grand strategy, apart from the difficulty of, you know, the Middle East just keeps surprising people. You have Arab uprisings, you have wars, you have, you know, all kinds of things that have to be responded to, that are not under anyone's real control. There is that I think has made grand strategy a kind of fool's errand in the Middle East. But there are two other points that I'd really like to have both of you dwell on a little bit. One is the fact that in these two democracies, okay, both of them have their problems as democracies, but by and large, public opinion counts for something, elections count for something. It seems to me that domestic politics plays an outsized role in influencing the way in which foreign policy issues and strategic issues are addressed. I mean, time after time, it looks as if political leaders are looking over their shoulders at either the electoral calendar or public opinion or coalition partners who may be uneasy with one aspect or another of their foreign policy overtures. I don't think it should be precluded that some of the rather extreme rhetoric that we've seen from Prime Minister Erdogan in the last few weeks was precisely driven by a judgment that this would be good domestic politics. Nothing like kind of stirring up the notion that there are foreign enemies and that they've penetrated our security services and one of our enemies sits in Pennsylvania and does mysterious things. I think that was all, I mean, it's surprising that he did pretty well in the recent elections, which makes me think that Erdogan is a politician before he's a strategist. And quite frankly, I would say the same thing about Benjamin Netanyahu and most of his predecessors. When I look at the cast of Israeli prime ministers that I've known either something about or have known, I can think of a few of them who stand out as strategists who were also politicians. I think Rabin fit that model. I think actually Begin did. I mean, Begin was a very difficult guy to deal with, but he had a sense of what he wanted to achieve and how to do it. By contrast, I don't think any of the recent prime ministers comes across as first a strategist and then a politician. I think they all look like relatively weak politicians who are dependent on coalition partners who make their lives quite miserable every time they think of moving in a different direction, perhaps Sharon a little bit in a different category. So domestic politics makes grand strategizing extremely difficult, maybe particularly in democratic polities. The second thing that I'd like you to reflect on, because I think both of you have come close to hinting that this is a factor in the two cases you're talking about, is the particular role of individuals. You have Prime Minister Erdogan, who I think in Yaprak's paper comes across as the architect of current Turkish foreign policy. There's nobody else in his league. Maybe the foreign minister helps to round out the rough edges, but foreign policy has become really the province of the prime minister. And by and large, it seems as if the same is true in Israel. The prime ministers, if you can say that anybody is in charge of foreign policy, it is the prime minister. So is it the case that the individual makes enough difference that we have to look at that as a source of variance, or do they all come up against the same structural realities, the same bureaucratic realities, and have to trim their sails and essentially limit their ambitions to relatively predictable courses of action? I mentioned this in the case of Israel because two things strike me as being rather distinctive about Netanyahu in two important arenas of foreign policy. One is that Netanyahu has made the issue of recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, a factor that, in all honesty, I don't think was on the agenda in a very important way in a previous period. It was either taken for granted or it was simply not part of the negotiations. Egypt did not recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Jordan did not recognize Israel as a Jewish state, for that matter, neither did the United States. We all recognized Israel as a state. The partition resolution did mention it as a Jewish state, but there's been no specific demand up until Netanyahu that this be part of the negotiations. Is this his particular quixotic demand, and is there a strategic reason behind it, or is it actually something that most Israelis really care a lot about, and he's reflecting public opinion? I honestly don't know. The other thing that I would like to ask about Netanyahu is that he has pretty clearly put the threat from Iran, which I wish you would talk a little bit more about, as Israel's top strategic challenge, rather than making peace, say, with the Palestinians, which he rather grudgingly goes through the motions of doing, but without any sense that he is really committed to it. But he does seem to be constantly trying to move the discussion back to Iran. How much of that is a deep reflection that Israeli sort of strategic thinking, strategic concern has shifted toward a preoccupation with Iran as a nuclear power? Or is it once again a fairly tactical way of changing the conversation from something that's much more difficult in domestic terms just to get a consensus over how to deal with the Palestinians? I think with those comments, I'll pass the floor back to our chair and we'll join the conversation later.
Yeah, Bill, thanks very much for those. Those are stimulating issues to think about. And I think we should start perhaps by letting Yaprak and Ellie respond to some of these particular issues that were raised, and then we can throw it out to a wider discussion.
Thank you very much for the comments. I believe that, I can summarize their comments as, you know, how much of this is Prime Minister Erdogan, his ideological orientation. Basically, you know, the title of the paper, you are asking me, you know, how much influence does this one man and his ideology have. And I put a question mark to the title of the paper for that reason. I don't think that it's Erdogan and his ideological orientation only. I don't think that that's the case. I think that definitely the international system plays a role here. What's going on in the region plays a role here. I mean, if the Arab Spring hadn't happened, if there wasn't a war in Syria, maybe we would see the continuation of the same foreign policy, and I would be talking about Ahmet Davutoğlu being a very important leader and a decision maker in Turkish foreign policy. So definitely, I think what is going on in the region and in the system, international system, is important. And I agree that, you know, it wasn't only the Justice and Development Party coming to power and changing policies with regards to Israel. I mean, I had a paper in a previous conference where I basically argued against it, that there was always this type of populism against Israel before Erdogan and Davutoğlu came to power. In fact, I mean, this was the reason why in the paper, you know, I tried to give the historical background. Because it's not, I mean, Erdogan is in some respects going back to the historical way of conducting Turkish foreign policy. So that defensive attitude, not necessarily status quo oriented, but that defensive attitude, appealing to the voters' nationalistic sentiments and using populism and using religion, it has always been there. Maybe it wasn't as much pronounced as it was today in terms of religion, but nationalism was always there. And, you know, blaming the EU, blaming the US, I mean, these are not new. In 1997, for instance, the EU was out the door and, you know, Turkey was like, what the hell with them? We are going to do our own thing. And then they changed their minds when the EU opened the door and gave a candidate status. And I believe that the EU is a very important component of Turkish foreign policy here. And this is something that Turkey can and cannot necessarily control. If the Justice and Development Party government had continued with the reforms, maybe we wouldn't be in this state, domestic reforms, and maybe the EU negotiations would have been more successful. But also the EU's response to Turkey is something that the current government cannot control, and they have to work with what is given to them. So the EU rejects them. The Middle East is in a state of chaos, and they want to appeal to their voters, so this is the mix that they're coming up with. But I think still that an individual and his mindset plays an important role. In the conclusion, you know, I tried to say that maybe the grand, maybe the borders of Turkish foreign policy would have looked the same, but it could have been still less populist and sectarian. It didn't have to be this pronounced, and it didn't have to be like in every speech that Erdogan delivers. He talks about this evil forces, and it's amazing. And he goes back to the same theme again and again, and this is definitely for public consumption and to increase his vote share. And nothing brings more popularity than blaming outside forces and saying that, you know, this is not his fault. What is happening is not the government's fault. And he's the only one trying to resist them. And this strategy is working. Somebody else probably would have had a different discourse, I think. So it's still important to mention him and his orientation. And talking about individuals, I must mention that I think with the military's power eroding, especially in 2008 with the start of the coup investigations, there was a vacuum in foreign policy decision making. And that vacuum was filled by Erdogan and his undersecretary of the National Intelligence Agency, Hakan Fidan. So they filled the gap. There was no other institution that could replace the military. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs could still play an important role, I believe, but that Davutoğlu, as the minister, I think, kind of, because he's a strong character, played down the influence of the bureaucrats in the ministry. They can come back. To an important position in later years if the government changes, for instance. But the fact that there was no institution, I think, gave the opportunity to Erdogan to fill the gap. Mm-hmm.
Just want to say, sometimes I think, just in our own discourse, when we inject the word grand strategy, sometimes we distort the issue of whether there's strategy. I mean, I think just by using that adjective, grand strategy, we may distort what we're trying to get at. And what, you know, we purposely entitled this conference Comparative Strategy because we're really interested in trying to ask the question and interrogate whether governments and policymakers think strategically and make strategy or frame foreign policy within a coherent strategy. And one of, I think, the essential questions that Bill raises is, can countries operating in a very pluralist system like Israel, democratic framework, do they really plan foreign policy within a strategic framework, or do domestic politics totally distort that? I think that's a really key issue. So it also bears upon how policy is made in the U.S. and every other country, every other democratic country as well. But that's particularly salient in the case of Israel, for example. Yeah, Ari?
Bill, your questions are obviously easier to pose than to answer. So I treat it as a compliment. Let me try and say, I think I have a slightly better answer on one than I have on the other. I'd love to get Jim's perspective, by the way, and I'll provoke him enough to actually do this, because he has dealt with some of these individuals when he was in the government, and I don't think that he stopped thinking about that since. But I would argue on the first point is that the dividing lines between domestic policy and foreign policy in Israel do not exist. I've already given a couple of examples. I could go more. Is Pollard, by the way, a domestic issue in Israel, or is it an international issue? We can debate this, but I don't. I think it's fundamentally a domestic issue. Even the definition of who is Jewish, is that a domestic issue or international issue? It's not just a domestic issue. The Arab countries feel that it has a bearing on the way Israel behaves. The international jury and the American jury have a very strong view on this issue. So we try to pass legislation regulating interrogations. And by the way, with much more stringent rules than exist in the United States. Who opposed Israel legislating this? The Europeans. They would rather not have it out in the open. We tried to do something on generic drugs. We ran into the same problem. I would argue that it's that our capacity. Israel is so penetrated by the international environment and in general, and the U.S. in particular. There is no distinction, none, that is relevant in the way, the classical way, as I was brought up as a political scientist to look at. We had talked about efforts of Prime Minister Netanyahu to play games with American politics here. Prime Minister Netanyahu is absolutely convinced that in the first term, President Obama was trying to bring him down. And a lot of his reactions were tailored to that. And by the way, both of them have enough to go on to explain why it actually sort of made them behave in certain ways that would otherwise be difficult to explain. And just to give you the kind of a funny aspect to this, when someone asked to refer to Ron Dermer, who is now the American Israeli ambassador to Washington, but had previously been the foreign policy advisor of Prime Minister Netanyahu, he referred to him as the foreign policy advisor. He says, I'm not the foreign policy advisor of the Prime Minister. I'm the domestic policy advisor of the Prime Minister on U.S. domestic policy. So what happens is, so what I'm trying to say is, so I've said domestic policy and foreign policy. I mean, domestic policy in Israel, domestic policy in the U.S. on key issues pertaining to Israel are so intertwined now that are very difficult to separate and permeate every single issue that is on the agenda. And if I now go to the discussion of Iran, the Iran issue quickly evolved from a discussion about Iran to a discussion about the United States. And for the last couple of years, the outcome has been shaped more by the perceptions of the Israeli-American dialogue and how strongly the U.S. feels about Israel doing or resisting doing certain things than it is how gravely we see the Iranian threat. And you can call it a U.S. success, you can call it a U.S. failure, you can call it a mixture of both, but the issue is framed first and foremost, and the U.S. actively tried to manipulate the positions of key players within the Israeli system. The Israeli president in particular, but also the military and so on, so they worked on every single element within the Israeli a political sphere, not just the media, but the key players within the state organs to try and shape their view of that issue and so on. But now specifically to the question of Prime Minister Netanyahu. First of all, I think you got it, Bill. I think you got it absolutely right when you described the person anything but a strategist. So I don't think there is any light between us on this one, number one. And I don't think that he's inclined to think. I think what separates Netanyahu 2 from Netanyahu 1 or Netanyahu 2 and 3 from Netanyahu 1 is that he's become a much better politician than he'd been originally, although all of this is now coming to a head because the question is he more of a domestic politician or more of a kind of a domestic politician with some international flavor to him?
He's pretty good in U.S. politics.
No, but the issue really is, as the way I read it, he had completely lost his party. Completely. He has zero support within the party. And in fact, he's now sort of running a huge risk of actually losing every bit of influence
over their agenda, precisely because he's trying to craft a broader political agenda. But to the specific question that you have raised, two. One is, he was not the one who came up with the Jewish state. Actually, Tzipi Livni was the first one who was trying to make that a front, and I think mistakenly, but that's an aside. Has been trying to reclaim now ownership of this issue with little success now. That's one. And with very little understanding of what kind of issues come up because in that context. But she was trying to use it as something to offset a much more generous policy on the part, whereas Bibi had taken it a little bit in the opposite direction, as something that explains why it is we can't make concessions, whereas she was trying to use this to legitimize concessions. So it actually plays very differently in their strategy. But I think the only person who had thought about this strategically is Lieberman. And still does, in very interesting ways. So I don't think that that's... I don't give Netanyahu credit for... And in fact, what is quite remarkable in the recent discussion with... You know, and here again, you can see that where is the domestic policy? If it's the U.S. that is heavily involved in defining what do we actually want to get out of this discussion of a Jewish state, is it a Jewish state or Israel is the homeland for the Jewish people? Which is what Secretary Kerry has apparently offered, which the Palestinians would still reject, but nevertheless. And I don't think that Bibi has a clear view whether he wants one or the other as part of that discussion. But now Iran versus the Palestinians. Let me say the following. On the one hand, I think Bibi felt that on the Iran issue, he has a much more of a domestic consensus than he has on the Palestinians. By the way, over time, he was proven wrong. That whereas every Israeli is concerned about Iran, nuclear and otherwise, and I think the otherwise is very important too, you know, trying to shift a shape of the events in Gaza Strip and Hezbollah and so on, Syria, of course, whatever. Nevertheless, he sort of over time he discovered that the Israeli public takes the general preoccupation with Iran not to be automatically leading in the direction of let's take them on militarily. But in any event, his perception was that this was something we have all had in common, and in a very abstract sense, he's right. Okay, whereas on the Palestinians. I think at every level that you look at, depending on what resolution you want to imply, ranging from his domestic household to his party, to his coalition, to the Israeli population as a whole, there is absolutely no consensus. So one possible interpretation would basically say, here is something I could run with and generally be politically ahead, as distinguished from, and here is an issue that I can't run with, because the public is deeply divided and so on, and not being a very much of a strategist in the first place. I don't doubt that he feels very strongly about Iran, but I would argue that in practice, he's been dealing, sometimes reluctantly, more with the Palestinian issue than he's actually been dealing with the Iran issue, for reasons that having to do with, on the one hand, the pressures on the settlers. On the other hand, the pressure from his coalition partners. Thirdly, because the U.S. is playing such an important role, Europe to a lesser extent, but U.S. is playing such an important role on whatever the next, the last increment of settlement freeze or settlement expansion and definition of that issue and so on. And because the security establishment is forcing him repeatedly to confront it reluctantly. He doesn't want to confront it, but the security establishment repeatedly comes up to him on issues of anywhere from coexistence with the security services to a normalization of life in the territories and so on. So I would argue he's dealing with it a great deal more than he's actually dealing with the Iran issue. But the result is indeterminate. But I think that his position on that one has somewhat changed over time in response to this. So he's torn between, say, an ideology that would take him in one direction But that rift between the ideology and the pragmatic thing leaves him somewhat in the limbo.
Okay, let's... yes, please. Yeah.
I'm sorry, was that...
No, that's exactly what I wanted for everybody to be included in, to sort of frame some questions directly at some of the issues raised in these papers and the whole core concept of what we're trying to get at. Yeah.
Well, I have a question for Yaprak, which is something that you didn't address at all and I think couldn't be expected to address, but I think it's something of a hidden issue in Turkish foreign policy, which would be worth exploring, and that is Turkey's relationship with Germany, where the biggest Turkish diaspora lives, and this ties onto Ellie's comments about the Israeli diaspora. The Turkish diaspora is, I think, currently contributing to the biggest shift in German identity and German culture that I've seen in my lifetime. We were joking earlier, but it's really not a joke. The best stand-up comedians in Germany are now German Turks. I've never seen us be so comprehensively skewered and nailed as by these guys, mostly men, some women. And I think that the successive Turkish governments I've seen have comprehensively failed to understand what an enormous strategic asset they have in this diaspora, and that this is a strategic bridgehead into Europe. Fail to see, but that could be incredibly useful in so many ways. But it would have to involve, I think, Turkish governments and politicians thinking about Europe and about their diaspora in a completely different way. Just as a footnote to that, most Turkish diplomats, I think, the first thing they say when you say they realize you're German, they will say, "I'm really sorry that you have all these uncultivated Anatolian peasants, living in your country, who give you the worst sense of how great and how cosmopolitan we really are." And then you say, "Actually, well, some of the cabinet ministers by now, it's a little more complicated than maybe you think." Anyway, that's just a suggestion, and not something, obviously, for this paper, but I think it would be worth exploring.
Yeah, Jim?
That's great. I have one big one for Ellie and one smaller one for Ellie. As you know, one of the great conundrums of Israeli strategy is the question of independence versus the need to have the support of the United States. And, for a long time, this kind of it was canonical that we have to be able to defend ourselves, and we can't rely on anybody else. We learned in the past, blah, blah, blah. And I'd just be interested if you reflect a little bit more on sort of how the Iran thing has changed that calculus some, and how, in particular, on the one hand, the desire to retain the autonomy to deal with the Iranian problem because you don't know what the United States would do, but also recognizing that if Israel were to exercise an autonomous response, that it would absolutely need the United States for the second day. And you and I have talked about this infinitely, which is why I'm encouraging you to talk about it with others, because I think the most dramatic fact of this unbelievable relationship with the United States and Israel is it's the only relationship that doesn't have a treaty, right? I mean, it is. We have everybody else that we are closely aligned with. We have a treaty, and Israel is the one country which arguably we're closest to of all and don't. So maybe that question about how that fits into the strategy. And I guess maybe one more point on this, which is, the other piece of strategy, which you don't talk a lot about, and maybe it's just because it's a thing of the past, was in the old days with Paris and beyond, the idea that there were a set of partners beyond the immediate Arab neighbors who could be strategic influencers in the context of trying to find a place for Israel in the neighborhood, Morocco, the UAE, Qatar, all the things that were trying, and that seems to have dropped out, but I'd be interested in your reflection on that. And Albert, I recognized everything you wrote about. Your last point about sort of the evil forces really strikes me as the dynamic here. But it leads me to ask, whether at the end of the day, the conclusion you draw from this is that Davutoglu had a foreign policy and kind of an IR person's view about the world. But Erdogan never did. He had a domestic policy for changing Turkey dramatically, and that his adaptation of the policy, from no enemies to everybody's the enemy now, is just a function of how he's trying to sustain and manipulate the domestic politics, and whether that can be reflected in the municipal elections. And then connecting to our broader discussion here, maybe you could say a word about Turkey's and Erdogan's relations with both Russia and China, because I think those are also really, so on the one hand, you could imagine that Turkey would see itself as a middle power aligning it. Certainly, vis-a-vis Russia, the economic interest became very intertwined. But there's a very complicated relationship with China for a number of reasons. And I'd just be interested in your reflections on how that fits in to Turkey's contemporary strategy.
Yeah, Kim?
I'd like to ask Ellie about the Russian relationship in Israel. I think it hits very much into the theme that you were raising about there being no distinction between domestic and international policy, partly because of who your foreign minister is. But also when I was in Israel a couple of years ago doing research in Jerusalem, I discovered that when I needed directions and I couldn't find someone who spoke English, I could easily find someone who spoke Russian who could give me directions in Russian. And I think it's striking on a number of levels, in addition to that sort of cultural and domestic politics issue. One is arms sales and the fact that Israel and Russia have a partnership there on defense issues that really sort of cuts against this idea that Russia or that the U.S. and Israel have a special defense relationship. And we've seen that very recently in Israel abstaining on the General Assembly vote on Crimea. So I wonder if you just sort of mention that too.
Were they accurate directions from the Russian speaking?
One was, one wasn't.
Yeah, I have a question.
Please.
Last summer I was in Xinjiang, and of course there are people inside and outside Xinjiang still regard Xinjiang as Eastern Turkestan. And where I meet a senior scholar from Israel, he's giving talk to a university in Xinjiang, and he told me that he used to be part of the government, now retired, teaching in the university in Israel, and Israel is making great effort to build up relationship with China. So I wonder whether or not you can comment on this. And I did a quick search of both of your paper, and China is not mentioned even once in both of your papers. So.
Yeah, Bill, please.
One other issue that I think on Yaprak's topic that I'd like to have her reflect on a little bit is the Kurdish area in Iraq. Pretty much you painted a picture of Turkey being on not very good terms with any of its neighbors, with one exception. It's on better terms, amazingly, with the Kurdish autonomous region of Iraq than anybody would have ever expected given the nature of the Kurdish problem in Turkey. And it's actually quite strategically important, and it seems to also have domestic implications, which politically could be quite important in a positive way for Erdogan. And if he hopes to run for president, he would benefit from getting votes from the small Kurdish party. And I think the relationship with the Kurds is actually quite a striking and potentially positive relationship, and it does show up in foreign policy. It means relations with the central Iraqi government are quite bad, which could also be part of what you mentioned as the kind of championing of Sunnis as opposed to Shia. Also has something to do with energy. We've perhaps not talked enough about how that affects Turkey's sense of what its kind of geostrategic environment is. And perhaps even, Ellie, I'd be interested in knowing whether Israel's discovery of gas makes any difference in terms of its sense of its geostrategic space and its relations with possibly Turkey as a way of exporting the gas. We keep hearing that the Turkish-Israeli relationship actually might improve fairly soon, which again would make me think if it does, that Erdogan played the Israel card for electoral purposes more than for deep strategic alienation from Israel.
My sense is of the conversation that we're having is that we're starting to talk too much about specific policy issues and differences and bilateral relationships, which is, of course, critical to the papers, but that I know that Mel and Jeff and I have talked a lot about what we're trying to achieve in the volume, and one of those things is to try to assess some points of comparison about how these states think very broadly about conceptual problems of strategy making. Maybe we're just making it too abstract, and really we fundamentally ought to be talking about essentially the foreign policies of these seven countries, but we've sort of been trying to get away from that because it just becomes almost a kind of encyclopedic dumping ground of lots of details. And I want to make sure that from time to time we bring it back up to the elevated maybe esoteric level, but I think it's important to do that. And there are just three things that I wanted to ask that these two panels, but maybe everybody else. Ellie, I loved your notion of the virtual relocation. That Israel basically doesn't, is pretending it doesn't live in the neighborhood that it lives in, just lives somewhere else. Is that, is it, or is Israel the only country of our seven that is, for the, for whom that is the case? Basically, all of the other states seem to be wanting to shape, frame, maybe dominate their neighborhood, and are seeking various means to do that, soft, hard, balancing alliances. But if you're right, Israel is essentially saying we're going to build a wall and just pretend we live somewhere in a virtual place that looks and feels like Western Europe or I don't know where, Florida.
Nevada.
So is that a point of comparison for the other experts? The other point of comparison I wanted to raise was, Ellie, it came out of your paper, was the formal process is not very revealing. If we look at the formal process, we're going to miss what's really happening, and that seems to me very useful. To what extent is what's really happening not happening in the institutions we would normally look at to examine the making of strategy? It's happening in well, where else? Is it in the public domain? Is it just individuals and individual charismatic leaders? Is it in bargains that are happening that are invisible and to scholars and analysts? I'd love to hear more from everybody about the formal versus the reality of strategy making. And then the last one is, I think, something that has come up in almost all of the papers, and it looks very strong in these two, and that is the core identity of the nation. And Ellie, you made a very strong case that the core identity in Israel is in. I think you said it's in crisis. If maybe flux is where you is what you meant, but I think you really said that there's an acute identity crisis.
By the way, both are true. It's in a flux.
It's in flux and it's in crisis. And so great, good. There's another point of entry, perhaps, for comparison. To what extent all of these states, all states, are constantly going through some development of its of their identity, but perhaps there's a degree of urgency and the pacing is dramatically different in the seven countries we're looking at, or is, again, Israel a case where the pace is really hyperspace, so to speak? So those are just some ways of forgetting all of these papers talking to each other.
Yeah, and I'd like to reiterate the initial point that Will said about thinking about the salience of strategy making in relationship to these. I mean, when we talk about strategy, usually we think about our policymakers or governments defining priorities in a clear and a coherent way. Do we see that happening in Turkey and Israel? And if not, why not? So is there an effort to define priorities? Is there a clear effort to link means and ends? And if not, why not? Is it because issues like core identity or memory or other things interfere with that? So if we can sort of stay on a more conceptual and general basis rather than sort of gravitate into individual issues, however interesting they are, I think it will help us a lot in terms of...
Well, and linking the levels is the key, right?
You know, right.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I had an additional question that's along those lines, which is trying to get at this issue of personalistic policies versus enduring policies or things that might change. I it was struck by it in your paper, Yaprak, which was seemed so centered around Erdogan, but it was true of others as well. And it just made me think that one way to get at that is to think about, well, what is the alternative kind of orientation being offered in these debates? And what might shift things to that other orientation? And if change in leaders wouldn't shift them, then maybe we don't need to be thinking about changes in leaders so much, right? Erdogan goes, do we still get a state that's really building an identity around a kind of lead, a Sunni identity, but still integrated in markets and so on and so forth.
Yeah, Prak, I'll let you respond to these various comments.
So I'm not going to dwell into bilateral relations that much. I thought that I actually addressed them in the paper without focusing the entire paper on bilateral relations. I tried to do a balancing job in the paper. But I didn't address China, and I was going to actually do that, but I ran out of space, and it felt like, you know, it didn't fit anywhere. What I was going to mention that, and it's similar to Turkey's policy with regards to Russia also. Turkey believes that the BRICS are an important group, and Turkey wants to be part of the BRICS, but is not right now. So this is a major problem for Turkey and for Erdogan, and therefore Erdogan wants to have good relations with Russia, with Brazil. They established good relations, you know, and the Iranian swap deal was done with Brazil. And in many respects with Brazil, we can see that Turkey has sought similar policies. But with Russia, despite, you know, several problems in relations that I tried to address in the paper, Erdogan keeps appealing to Putin and saying, you know, please include us in the Shanghai Five, and, you know, even saying, like, if the EU doesn't want us, so let us in Shanghai Five, which is ridiculous, you know. And with China, Turkey has used China, for instance, to balance against NATO or the West. So both in terms of relations with Russia and China, Turkey uses it as a kind of, you know, a balancing act. Like, if you reject us, then we have Russia and China. And so what they did with China was, for instance, they asked to get missiles from China, and NATO refused this, saying that, you know, the Chinese missiles would not work in our system. And this was Erdogan trying to work out a better deal with NATO. And interestingly, I spoke with military generals, and they were so proud. I mean, they hate Erdogan, you know, but they were so proud that he actually stood up against NATO and used China as a, you know, as a mechanism there. So I think we will see Turkey trying to have better relations with these countries, at least to use against the West. Well, the core identity of the Turkish nation is, you know, the main problem here, I think. And that relates to your question as well. If Erdogan goes and another leader comes, and if there is another political party right now in the elections, definitely the Sunni identity of the country would not be this pronounced. Definitely. I mean, I have no doubt whatsoever. If the CHP wins the elections, it would be a miracle. But let's say the miracle happens and we have a new government. They would continue with the old policy of not, being in connection with the Middle Eastern neighbors, trying to be status quo oriented, trying to be defensive, and maybe make some populistic gestures to the domestic audience, but that's it. I don't think that they would be referring to Turkey being, the leader of the Sunnis, and, you know, I don't think that it would happen. So I really think, and believe me, it's very difficult for me to say that it's an individual and his ideological motivations are the driving force here. I thought that I was a realist. Maybe I'm growing up or something, I don't know. But it was very difficult for me to, put this on paper. But I think that there's no other way to interpret Turkish foreign policy right now. And what would change? I mean, the alternative orientation would be the old policy continuing, basically, being defensive and status quo oriented, and not try to involve, especially with Syria. I mean, many people criticize Turkey's policy in Syria. Do we have to send arms to Syrian insurgents? Do we have to have an open borders policy? Nobody says, you know, that these are a must. It's the decision of the government, I think. Yeah, I guess.
Let me start with Jim's questions in reverse order. Number one, on partners in the region. The partners that are mentioned in the papers that I haven't touched in my brief comments this morning are Egypt and Jordan. They're very important. And Egypt, hugely important. And that
amazing aspect is that although not all much, that much is discussed and publicly about this, even under Morsi, the relationship with the defense establishment in Egypt was quite good. Now it's even better, and the issues at stake are enormous, starting with the Sinai, but going also in terms of the, you know, the Gaza Strip and other issues and so on. So the peace treaty and the type of the security problems have actually elevated those to a very prominent role. There was just a discussion there over the holy places with the Jordanians over the last couple of days and so on. The Jordanian nuclear ambitions and energy is another issue. There is tight coordination. Clearly, Jordan with the Iraq issue was very important role and so on. You're right that the others who are kind of the second tier are by and large less important than they have been. The only there is a very good relationship with the Kurds, by the way. But the only one that I would mention where I think there is, in the broader scheme that you have described, where there is an exception of a uncertain nature, is the sense that maybe we're now lumped together historically with the Saudis and the UAE, because the US is less there and our interests are aligned. And in fact, they don't make the Palestinian issue a make or break issue the way they used to. It's still a barrier to formal ties, but not to the extent. And so we should work together. We can talk about the viability of this long term, but I'd rather not get there, and so on. On the U.S.-Israel autonomy versus independence, I think you captured it absolutely right, predictably. But I would say the following. I would sort of say, look, there is consultation, cooperation, coordination. The consultation and cooperation couldn't be closer. Okay? The coordination is actually bringing the tensions to the fore. That is, at the end of the day, would we take a decision which the U.S. Be categorically opposed to. And I think that is the kind of issue that Bibi was actually confronted with, and every single member of the coalition and the cabinet actually was confronting. And I think that de facto answer was no. Would there be circumstances under which the answer might change? Maybe. But I think there is, everyone understands the gravity of the issue at stake and the fact that we're essentially in this together as we're in together in so many other issues. So so we can go on and on with this issue, but I think on the whole, because it cuts into defense industry, it cuts into intelligence, it cuts in, and it goes in so many complicated directions.
But you're saying it isn't changing the qualitative nature of the relationship, which is what I took his question to be.
No, it's actually put the question, in many ways it actually brought us closer on this one, because we had to work our way through a very difficult challenge and managed to come ahead.
If you think about the difference between, you know, 67 and 73, on the one hand, where, you know, they did it and we had to deal with it, and now a situation where it's not so obvious. I mean, it does seem to me there's at least an issue about whether there's bad.
I'll tell you a short story just as kind of to be on the lighter side of things. 2007, the Sirion reactor on the agenda. Israel is led to believe that the U.S. will ultimately, by the time the U.S. is persuaded it's real, which takes a while, when Israel presents it with and so on, Israel is led to believe that the U.S. will actually take the action, the necessary action, and ultimately decides that he won't. And the way it looks is there is a telephone conversation between the president and the prime minister, in which the president of the United States tells the prime minister, A, we won't do it, we can't do it, and two, we implore you not to do it yourselves. And Olmert says to the president, we respect, you know, sort of your decision, but we will do. But we will do it. And then the president hangs the phone and then says to his staff, "Well, the guy got balls," and we go ahead and do it. So it was clearly led to believe that there was the U.S. was not going to do it, did not encourage Israel to do it, but would go along if Israel went ahead and did it. So. Which I think Iran is a different story.
But so, I mean, what was the lighter part of the story?
The lighter part of the sword.
The lighter part?
The lighter part. You said just for...
The lighter part. The lighter part of the story was George, the way George Bush frames issues.
Oh, the ball. Okay.
Give me. Russians in Israel. Russian in Israel. I would say the following. I think that on the whole, Russia doesn't play an important role in any way, shape, or form, other than, you know, kind of an anecdotal aspect. And that the arms sales are very marginal and tightly coordinated with the United States in terms of the kind of issues the U.S. can live with it and so on. And it's mainly defensive in the sense of trying to prevent the Russians from doing things that would be highly inimical to Israeli interests. Say S-300, we've mentioned already once, twice, three times, four times, don't provide our adversaries or do things which are totally inimical to Israeli interests. Nobody believes that Putin, at the end of the day, wakes up in the morning and thinks of us particularly fondly.
He does.
But at the same time,
he does. Thinks of you very fondly.
Well, no, I don't think so. Well, not nobody, but that he's on the other hand. I wanted to say the other part of it. Nobody believes that he thinks of us particularly adversely either.
He's got a lot of oligarch friends who are dual.
Yes,
citizens.
But at the end of the day, he's done a lot of things which we feel are problematic from Israeli security and so on, with respect to his other policies on Iran and Syria and so on. But but Crimea was framed as essentially two things. First and foremost, enormous pressure from the Israeli Jews, from the Jews in Ukraine and in the Crimea, that they're in trouble if Israel takes a clear position.
Interesting.
That either from Ukrainian nationalists or from the Russians. And so if you take a clear position, you put some of those Jews in immediate jeopardy. And so the result was that the state felt that it had no choice but to. And the second is exactly managing this relationship with Russia, where you don't put the Russians in a position where they kind of take this as an...
this is in a way too early, but I do want to know what you thought. I thought part of the reason, too, was that they just don't like the General Assembly voting on these things.
Oh, General Assembly, I don't think anyone attributes any...
But given their historic, you know, the fact that they've always been marginalized and it's been used as a tool, I think that part of the reason that they voted against it.
But I'm trying to say more fundamental in terms of the outlook, because we remained remarkably quiet on this issue. And the main reason is the Jews were crying foul. I mean, they're saying, watch out what you do, you're putting us at risk. And in both Crimea and in Ukraine. Israeli relationship with China. I said in my comments what I did not say in the paper. This is now a front and center issue in Israel. Economically, strategically, politically, and so on. The number of dialogues, visitors, and so on. And the real issue, but the real issue it's framed is, how consistent is it with American-Israeli relations? And to what extent Israeli-American relations constrain or, in fact, encourage, because there is commonality of interest between the U.S. and China as far as Middle East issues are concerned, as distinguished from others. Yes, discoveries, Bill. One aspect we haven't talked about was the Russians tried to get in the game with Gazprom. And the answer was no. The Australians are trying to get into the act, and the answer is going to be yes. Heavy U.S. role, of course. Not much of a role for the Europe, predictably. And Turkey, I think, is very much in the cards. And in fact, if you would actually see the evolution of Israeli-Turkish relations, notwithstanding the ups and downs with Erdogan, Turkish Airlines now has 7 flights a day between Istanbul and Tel Aviv. Just Turkish Airlines. There are other airlines flying that route. So the economic ties have skyrocketed. There is more political dialogue than actually meets the eye. What has changed, of course, is the relationship with the military and a very troubled relationship with Mr. Hikan, but again, not to the point that there is no dialogue. So the issue of Turkey is a very complicated one. Virtual relocation, Will. I think that this is, I don't think that it's exclusively an Israeli phenomenon, but I would say that we have taken it to a whole new level. And we can discuss about what are the prospects of actually succeeding, what does it take to sustain it.
The relevance of the formal process, I would say that indeed I haven't put a lot of attention, sort of weight to the formal process. There are few exceptions. The most important is the Supreme Court. A disproportionate role of the Supreme Court. Not because it's the Supreme Court, but it's the higher court of justice. So there is this where every citizen can appeal. So every issue now become an issue, and particularly after a couple of presidents of the Supreme Court have actually taken kind of a more liberal approach towards what should they rule on. The current one is a bit more conservative. But we have a different system than yours in terms of how they appointed the judges and whatever and so on. So, I mean, institutionally, they are the most important institution, I think, and which has an enormous role on many of the issues that we talked about. core identity is my only point here is to say, I think we're all dealing now with multiple identities. And in fact, we have a couple of psychiatrists writing in the Israeli papers about Israeli schizophrenia or whatever and so on, and you actually bring psychiatrists to say, you know, but I think when you talk about Germany and you talk about other, mm-hmm. we're all becoming much more complex societies with multiple identities and so on, and that's therefore, I think, in terms of thinking across, this is a very useful concept. Efforts to define priority mail, I would say that the trick that was used that nobody had fully understood, I think, with the exception of the people who initiated it, is the person who is about to become the deputy head of the Federal Reserve, Stan Fisher, while governor of the Bank of Israel, played a disproportionate role in trying to impose priorities by doing a very clever thing, getting Israel into the OECD, which would then put it on a certain trajectory by virtue of you know, that belong, you finally belong to some group rather than, and so on, that dictates priorities economically and socioeconomically and so on, and you can't imagine the impact that this is already having. Yeah. So there was a clear effort, a trick that was used that ties to two of the questions and so on. I actually think that the concept of grant strategy is useful, not in the sense that it's grant, but in the sense that the various components of the strategy come together, which is the way I've looked at it and so on. And you're absolutely right to try to focus more attention on where personalistic is distinguished from institutional politics comes in. But I don't want to go too long.
Can I just say something? I realized that I didn't quite answer your question. In terms of defining priorities, making a clear effort of connecting means and ends, I think Turkey had it. Like, Turkey had a grant strategy. Davutoğlu had a grant strategy. And I think this is because he is a professor of international relations. He wrote it and he published it in an international relations journal. So, I mean, and
did no one read it? Because that's what the FEC, if he's a professor of international relations.
This thing's published in the IR journal.
They read it after you
became
4 minutes.
Exactly. So, I mean, and it was very clear-cut, you know. I mean, his book is a mess, but the articles are very good and they're very clear-cut. Turkey had a grand strategy, but it didn't work out because of regional developments. I mean, and what could they do? And Erdogan, I think, being an excellent politician, but not a strategist, filled the vacuum again. You know, I'm making the same comment again and again, but I think this is what happened. And living in another neighborhood, like virtual relocation, I think Turkey was doing that a little bit during the Cold War era, pretending that it's not in the Middle East, not seeing Iran, not seeing Syria, which was a threat, but focused more on internal politics and its relations with the West and the U.S. But after the Cold War, they abandoned that strategy. And they are now, I mean, they want to be in the Middle East and be the leader in the Middle East.
We're going to have to stop for lunch. And Bill, I know, has to leave and go to Washington. And it's been a very good discussion. I might just inject a note that we can talk about over lunch or later on. But strategy is not simply
having a set of fixed interests or priorities. It's also having a sense of threat and threat perception and a constant recalibration of priorities and interests in terms of the evolution and the dynamic of threat perception. And part of the process of strategy making is a constant reassessment of that. I mean, a grand strategy is not just a fixed strategy. It's something that's dynamic. When you talk to managers in industry and they constantly focus on strategy, one of the first things they'll tell you is the importance of strategy is the conceptual process of thinking about priorities and then constantly throwing a lot of them away in terms of new threats and challenges that emerge. And what in part what we're interested in is to sort of think about, is that going on within governments and how does it go on and how do perceptions of threat bear on definitions of interests and priorities and things of that sort. We can talk a lot more about this over lunch and this afternoon, and thank you all for your participation. And we go downstairs for lunch, and everybody's invited.
You can leave the stuff here, right?
Yeah, it's right. We're going to have...
You mean like the briefcase? Lunch, I don't know if we're going downstairs.
Is it outside?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe it's outside of this room and we just bring it
just,
in here.
Let me just... Yes, you can leave things. Logistical thing. Oh. For those of you who don't know the layout of the Miller Center, it stretches out that way a bit. You're welcome to poke around. And there's also a very nice patio and outdoor areas to sort of mill about, get some fresh air. So take advantage. It looks like it's a fairly nice day out.
And we'll reconvene about 10 to 2.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.